You're listening to a podcast by Martin Scott. Thanks for joining me today. Our subject, eschatology. Books, speculation, time charts, definite predictions, escape routes. What a minefield. How do we respond? I hope we can discover a healthy framework to shape our perspectives. Sit back, listen, be provoked, and enjoy. So let's get on with today's topic. Welcome now to podcast number 21. And with this one, we will conclude the first look at an overview on the book of Revelation. We will come back to some other issues later, particularly when we look at the issue of the millennium and also with regard to eternal punishment. Both those times we will come back to the book of Revelation. Today I'm going to pick up with the third movement in the series of four markers that we began on last time, those markers being the phrase in the Spirit. The third marker being in chapter 17. And I'm going to read here from verses 3 to 6 to give us the context. Then the angel carried me away in the Spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. The chapters between the throne room, chapter 4, the throne room vision in this chapter where we have punishment have revealed the opposition that is manifest against the purposes of God. The battle that we read about is both heavenly and earthly. It takes place at an angelic level. It also takes place at a human level and in particular at an institutional level. Those who comply are marked by a number on their foreheads or hands, and they can then buy and sell. Those who do not comply, those who profess that Jesus is Lord, and thus will not give allegiance to any impostor, they are marginalized and persecuted. The message of the book, though, is that they are the ones who actually overcome. The ones who seemingly are overcome are the ones who overcome as they seek to follow the Lamb wherever he goes, and therefore they enter into his destiny, which is to overcome. In chapter 11, verse 7, it says that the beast that comes up from the abyss attacks the two witnesses and overcomes them. In chapter 13, verse 7, it is the sea beast that is given power to overcome the saints. The battle is long. The outcome at times might appear uncertain, but as we read in this chapter, judgment comes at the appointed time. It is this appointed judgment that John is called to witness. He sees the prostitute, Babylon, judged. He sees the great city that rules over the kings of the earth, Revelation 17:18, being judged. Now, in the context of his day, this can only be a statement about Rome, the Babylon of his day. The prostitute who's taken the wealth of the world to herself through her unjust trade. The prostitute that John saw was riding on a scarlet beast. That scarlet beast is the sea monster from chapter 13. The monster seems to be symbolic of the empire in its military and political dimensions. The unjust trade is what rode in the back of the military exploits. The unjust trade is what rode on the back of the military exploits. The trade is based on what the empire's armies had achieved, and then how through their military power they controlled and maintained the flow of wealth back to the center of the empire, back to Rome. In chapter 18, we read that the kings of the earth In other words, the rulers in place throughout the empire and the merchants of the earth had grown rich in the process. But the message John brings to his day and needs to be heard in our day is that all empires will come to an end. There will be reversals in this age, pointing forward to the great reversal that will take place in the future. In her, we read that the blood of the prophets and of the saints and all of those who have been killed on the earth was found. In our day, the message is still relevant. Babylon is the city that rises up from the earth in independence from God. It's the empire that promises blessing to all who conform and marginalizes all who resist. It's the spirit that pervades the world that favors the few, promising a flow of life and security to those who will swear allegiance, while seeking to mask the reality that the real benefits flow to the few. The evil nature of empire is summed up well by Wes Howard Brooke, and he wrote this in the book, The Church Before Christianity. I quote, "Broadly speaking, empire refers to an organized system of power used against the many for the benefit of the few, which seeks legitimacy by claiming divine mandate." Or, to give empire a fuller critique, we have the words of Brian Walsh and Sylvia Kismat in Colossians Remixed, subtitled Subverting the Empire. They say, "Empires are totalizing by definition. In the words of the psalmist, imperial mouths lay claim to heaven and their tongues take possession of the earth. Empires are built on systemic centralizations of power and secured by structures of socio-economic and military control. They are religiously legitimated by powerful myths that are rooted in foundational assumptions, and they are sustained by a proliferation of imperial images that captivate the imagination of the population. It is the spirit of empire manifesting in the institutions that is in total contrast to the community of priests and kings that Jesus' blood has ransomed. It is this manifestation that John confronts head on. Little wonder in the judgment that is exercised against Babylon, false worship, chapter 17, verse 3, false rulership, 17, verse 18, and false trade, 18:11 to 13, are singled out. Those are the common characteristics that manifest in the context of empire. So the interpretation that seems to fit here is of judgment against the twin issues of the centralization of resources through exploitative unjust trade that use military oppression to sustain it. This is what Walter Wink eloquently calls the domination system. Having witnessed judgment being brought against the prostitute, John is ready for one more in the spirit experience. This time, it's not to see a prostitute in a desert, but to come up to a high mountain and to see what the blood of the Lamb has purchased. That is the final movement, the end product of all the battle that has gone on before, is a bride being prepared for her husband. So the four markers move from seeing the risen Christ to the throne room of heaven, where John sees that it is heaven that shapes the future, an ensuing battle where there is both a Babylon rising up from the earth that seems to overcome but will be judged, to the saints that have been warred against, have been marginalized, persecuted, and even many been martyred. But he sees that this is what is producing a bride fit for marriage to the Lord. That is the revelation that he comes with. There's another very similar movement in the book that can be followed. And we track this from chapter 1, verse 1, first of all, through to chapter 10, verse 8. Richard Bauckham uses this pattern of movement. Let me read to you chapter 1, verse 1. "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants what must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John. There we have a movement described in this way. A movement from God to Jesus. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him. It flows from God to Jesus. It has to come to his servant, but Jesus made it known by sending his angel to his servant John. So we have a movement from God to Jesus, from Jesus to the angel, and then from the angel to John. In chapter 5, verse 1, we read that the scroll is in the right hand of the one sitting on the throne. And then in verse 7, it moves to the hand of Jesus, who begins to break the scrolls that have bound it. In other words, the scroll moves from God to Jesus within chapter 5. In chapter 10, verses 1 to 2, John says that he saw a mighty angel coming down from heaven with a little scroll laying open in his hand. Assuming it is the same scroll, and it does use in Greek what is termed a diminutive of the word scroll, but it does seem likely that it's the same scroll that was in the hand of God. It is now gone from God to Jesus. It has been broken open. Now the angel has the scroll, and it's unbound. It is open. And he comes and brings the scroll to Jesus. This movement, then, is the movement that takes place from chapter 1, verse 1. By chapter 10, the seals are open, 6 of the 7 trumpets have been blown, and now we're in the time of, and I quote chapter 10, verse 6, when there will be no more delay, when the mysteries of God will be fulfilled, chapter 10, verse 7. So when John receives the scroll, everything is going to be unfolded. There will be no more delay. God's mystery, what has been hidden in times past, is going to be revealed and unfolded. John is told to eat the scroll, and when he eats it, it will be sweet in his mouth, but bitter in his stomach, for he will have to prophesy about, and we quote chapter 10, verse 11, many peoples, many nations, languages, and kings. The prophecies he must now give is about the destiny of the world. Nothing will hold back the purposes of God, and he must be one who proclaims this. John, as receiver of the revelation, stands for the body of Christ that throughout all ages must prophesy and witness that history will move towards its goal. History is shaped from heaven. It is released through the Lamb and must be proclaimed on the earth. Battle will be the result. Martyrdom will take place. The beast will seem to overcome, and the saints will be marginalized. But the proclamation is, Jesus the Lamb has overcome, and victory will be manifest. Justice will come. There will indeed be a new heaven and a new earth. That is another way of approaching the book following that movement. Given that the book is highly structured, there are many different approaches to entering it. Many, and perhaps all, will help give a fresh way into it. There is, I believe, an incredible depth to the book of Revelation. Now, there are often asked questions that we're not addressing in this series on Revelation. Questions about the tribulation, the Antichrist, a one-world government, and the millennium. Those will be addressed either directly or in passing as I plan to develop this series of podcasts. Where does the book leave us here now in the 21st century? There are many approaches to the structure of Revelation, but to reduce the book to a prediction of the future, I believe, is to seek to try and control the book. The images from the book and the pace of the book are to fill us with hope that we can participate with the purposes of God as we follow the Lamb. John does not simply write because the church was facing persecution. That was certainly on the horizon as Caesar worship was being instituted in many places. But I believe he writes to tell us that if we pick up the challenge to follow Jesus, we will face persecution. The cross has always confronted all oppressive powers, and the effects of the cross will shape history. So for those who follow the Lord of history, there could well be an experience of persecution and opposition, and indeed what many might see as failure. But to those who have seen the vision and remain faithful, they will become part of the ransom from every expression of humanity and take their place with him and reign. John's message is, overcome and don't shrink back. There's a challenge to be in the Spirit as John was. We can't determine how ecstatic or how otherworldly our experience might be. But the four major experiences John had, I believe, must shape us too. A vision of the risen Lord, a vision of the throne room of heaven, must be the foundations upon which we build. From those foundations, we can see with clarity that history will not go round and round in an endless circle, that there will be accountability demanded of all those, whether personal or impersonal, who have exercised authority, who have wielded power, and where injustice and oppression have been measured out, that judgment is going to fall. History will come to an end with all of creation being renewed. Genesis 1 will have a fitting final chapter. These are the visions that have to shape us in our day as to shape John and his hearer in his day. So, a little conclusion. Throughout the book, there is a major critique of empire, and there's a challenge to humility, to follow the way of the cross and of simple devotion to Jesus. We do not have in the book a detailed set of plans that plot our journey toward the end. It's far too much metaphor and apocalyptic language for that to be the case. Yet, as we read the book, the sense of intensity and pace increases. So, it's not unreasonable to suggest that there is validity in having a stronger expectation that the arena where the purposes of God are being outworked, i.e. the earth, human history, will become even more intense as history unfolds. We might not be given detailed plans, but we're given more than enough insight to ask for honesty of heart to follow Jesus in a way that will be authentic. For then we will be those who are making a difference to the future. Then our mouths will echo what our lives are calling for. In the words of Revelation, those words will be, Maranatha, even so come, Lord Jesus. In the coming set of podcasts, we'll switch from the cosmic dimension we've been looking at to the personal, to what happens after death, what is the fate of the unbeliever, and themes like that. So until then,
you've been listening to a podcast from Martin Scott. Check out the website at www.threegenerations.eu. I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.